Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Friday, September 12th, and we have Rudy Havenstein and Ira Harris. Let Rudy introduce himself, but before that, just a background on Ira's past: hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He's also served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also most recently. And Rudy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a private investor. I went on Twitter in 2013 under the nom de guerre of Rudy Havenstein, which was the Reichsbank president during the inflation back in 1923. And I intended that name to be a warning, not encouragement, but it seems people are taking it as, our policymakers are taking it as encouragement. But I've been, I've been listening to you guys for years, and my resume certainly is nothing like Ira's in terms of the markets. I think just ever since I was a kid, for some reason, I was drawn to financial topics like the stock market and everything. And then, so I've just been kind of soaking it all in for the last, 40 years, and listening to people like Ira. And, I always liked the guys that grew up in the pits in the 70s and things like that. The old timer, Greg Weldon's another guy I like, just these old school guys that, nowadays everything is, on financial media is so vapid, it seems. So you got some guys with some sense of history. And I think history is the main thing we should be looking at now. We you can forget economics as far as I'm concerned and just read history books and you'll see where we're going, which is not encouraging. But anyway, I try to be chipper and I try to make some jokes a lot, because, you can't be too serious. And Twitter's been great because I was able to connect with guys like you that I never in a million years would have been able to talk to, And so I appreciate that, and I'm honored to be here.
Well, great. Yeah, and thanks very much for the kind words on our podcast. And maybe we could begin with your macro view, Rudy, on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, I just heard today, I listened to a guy named Tony Greer, and he was talking about how, the market cap of NVIDIA is now greater than the GDP of Japan, and approaching that of Germany, I think he said. So, I think we're in a massive financial bubble that's been particularly spurred on by massive money printing and globally. And also, as Mike Green has explained very well, the passive flows, as long as that money's coming in, it's price insensitive investing. So it doesn't matter if NVIDIA is at $4 trillion or $40 trillion, they're going to, in market cap, they're going to buy more shares every time they get inflows. So I think Mike's point, warning, is that someday that'll reverse. I like to say I'm bearish in theory, but not in practice. I've been long, I haven't shorted a stock since 2009 because I'm not suicidal. And, I own a lot of stocks, and when they go up, I benefit. But I think there's a lot of people in this country, the majority, who do not benefit. I think half of people own no stocks, and I think of the remaining 40% or more that own stocks, it's for most of them it's a trivial amount, and you're really concentrating in the top, 1% or 0.1% the wealth, and it's growing. I mean, even some of the Fred charts I post show that it's been growing nonstop, lower left, upper right. And I don't think, that like a Guatemalan level of wealth disparity is good for this country. It's just getting worse. And and that bothers me because, my stocks are up, yay, but you don't want to live in a society where people get stabbed to death on trains or, shot in Chicago or shot at a political rally, So something is, they call it the K-shape. I don't like that term, but it's just, there's just a very divided economy. And it's very hand to mouth for half of America at least. So, and that concerns me. And doesn't seem to concern anybody else in financial media. So that's mm-hmm. where I'm at right now. I'm long, I'm long, and I'm very undiversified, I don't own anything that people would really, it's really popular. oddly enough, but I've done pretty well over the years.
I see. Great. Interesting. Good points. And your thoughts, Ira, are you in alignment or what are
Well,
your thoughts?
this is, yeah, this is such a, you know, a wonderful, because, right, and I love what Rudy says, you know, yes, I've been doing this since the mid-70s, towards the later end of the 70s, but I was academically, I actually worked on this by happenstance, because I was a political science major at Wisconsin and working on political economy, and I had lefties, nobody on the right, but I was a far lefty. So I was doing that, and I was studying multinational corporations and the money flows and the debt of the third world nations, especially with the people on the left who were far more knowledgeable, along with the Austrians, on the impact of the recycled petro debt and what was going to take place. And they were right. They had it absolutely right. So I mean, I learned a lot there, and then I was able to, in the, if to quote Deng Xiaoping, because I had a lot of theoretical background, I could, but that's nothing, because as Deng Xiaoping, as he was overturning the whole Mao process, famously said, "Practice is the sole criteria for judging the truth," and exactly what Rudy said, and that's what was able to turn China, because regardless of what he sees historically, it's the same thing that I see historically. I mean, we can read whatever you want. You want to read Fisher and Mises, you see these same things. And I'm more concerned about it from the Keynesian and the Austrian viewpoint, which is about the debt. And the debt is way out of control. But that makes for financial flows, and financial flows are the determinant factor for the way I make my living, and evidently Rudy too. And I'm listening to him talk about his portfolio. And I've laid out this portfolio over the last, certainly since May of 2020 through June, and things that we were doing. And yeah, I don't have tech stocks. I leave that to my wife, who's a far better stock picker than I'll ever be. She's with her, because she'll look through the minutiae as a CPA MBA, but that's not the way I look. I started a global macro view and looked down. So what did we bought banks. And not you, I don't own a U.S. bank now. I own J.P. Morgan, but I sold that out to purchase UBS at the time, and UBS was trading $9, $10. And I talked about it with you, Richard, and we bought Tokyo Mitsubishi, which I still think is a great bank. And people who are in the business don't even know, and they didn't know when it was trading $3.80 or $4, and they were paying a 4% dividend when interest rates were zero. I said, this is like buying a bond. But they also happen to own 22% of Morgan Stanley, which they did the same thing as Buffett when they bailed out. Buffett bailed out Goldman Sachs and got stock. Tokyo Mitsubishi bailed out Morgan Stanley in 08 and owns 22% of the company. And I would talk to so-called professionals, and I deem myself a professional, but they had no idea of it. You know, and my favorite was Commerce Bank, because Commerce was so underwater and so underappreciated after failing many times to be purchased by Deutsche Bank. But the only reason I'm bringing that up, because my portfolio is probably very much like Rudy's, you know, and between then mining stocks and commodity stocks. And one of the big things that we talked about with you, Richard, was something was taking place in 2021, which was every professional, every analyst from Eiken Green, and we've done podcasts with Eiken Green, I have great respect for Barry Eiken Green. But they were talking about the coming depreciation of the yuan. But in fact, the yuan went, let's be exactly, I've got my CQG in front of me, so I don't have to guess. But during that period, the yuan fooled everybody. Why? Because from May of 2020, the yuan actually rallied from where it was 7.10 to yuan to the dollar, and then by early 22, it was down to it made a low of 6.3. So that was a substantial move at a time when everybody was looking for the yuan to weaken, because they were going to protect their market share in the global downturn. But to me, that signaled that the Chinese were more interested in buying commodity prices collapsed. So they created a stronger yuan to stockpile all those commodities. And that's exactly what they did. They bought grains, they bought all kinds of metals, steel, copper. So you see these types of things, and that's how I look to invest. You know, I don't understand when I see what happened with Oracle this week. I there's no a stock of that a 600-700 billion stock to go up 30% in a day. I by any measure, I can't wrap my hands about it. If I can't understand it, it's just not riding it. It's not the way, because then it's gambling to me. I need to understand what I'm doing rather than, and I think that's the way Rudy goes about it too. And you can do very well that way. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, you mentioned Rudy that you were you're not shorting, you haven't shorted for some time. Is that because your view similar to the 1970s, like the 1968 to 1982 period, where equities didn't really go anywhere nominally, but in real terms went lower unless you were in the right things like commodities, maybe emerging markets, precious metals? Is that your view in terms of the long term? Yeah.
I mean, I've loved precious metals forever, but to me, you know, gold's not, excuse me, gold's not an investment. To me, it's like money. It's like JP Morgan, the original guy, said years ago, it's money. So I haven't bought gold in a while, but I was buying it when it was, you know, $400, you know, back in 2000. You know, it's really been an incredible bull market. I think it's probably outpaced stocks, you know, over the years. This rock, you know, as people like to disparage it, you know, in 2015 there was all the articles about, you know, gold is doomed, and you know, very prominent Intuit people were cheering the death of gold, and I think it's tripled or quadrupled since then. So I don't trade very much. I'm more of a guy, my style is more I wait, and you know, once or twice a year, when you know, like an April period or sometime like that, or you know, a real low like a 2020 or especially you know 2008, 2009, I just wait until I use a few technical indicators and things at and I look for extremes in selling, and that's when I you know, even though I'm sick to my stomach because the stocks I do own are generally, you know, because I have some stocks that I own forever, or I'd never sell them, and so they'll be down 50% just like everybody else at times. And even though you're dead, that's when you should buy stocks, is when you're sick to your stomach and you wish you'd never seen the stock market, you know. And that's what I do. And in fact, I think if I'd gone back and only bought stocks, you know, once a year or once every 2 years in size, I think that's the way to go. And I have the core holdings, some of them which I've had since, you know, 1990, and I have a trading, you know, where I'll be in and out. You know, like gold miners is classic that. I've exited too early, clearly. I was out a couple $100 ago on of gold on some of the gold related stuff. So, you know, but then again, if there's a nice correction, which may come at some point, I don't know. I think it's kind of long in the tooth. Everyone's talking about gold now, but then again, it really doesn't matter if China and India are buying tons. That'll overwhelm whatever, you know, US sentiment is. Most people, you know, what percentage of Americans own gold, you know, in any form? I mean, even GLD, it's got to be super low, right? And the institutions, like as people point out, they move 1% of their money from, you know, tech stocks into gold, and the, you know, gold stocks will go to the moon, which you know, which they've started to do, but I think it could, you know, it could be really impressive. So that's how I try. I try and wait for bottoms. And a lot of times, you know, I'll go, oh my God, this is so sold out, I'll buy, and then of course it'll go lower. So, and I'll buy more. You know, that's why I could never manage money, because I do things like that. If I believe in something and I think it's cheap and I buy it and then it goes lower, I'll generally buy some more. I don't use stop losses, which is another heresy. My thinking, which isn't unique, is that, you know, ri risk is not a decline. Risk is permanent loss of capital. And so I'm quite willing to wait. You know, you know, if I believe, you know, I'll sit with a loss for a couple of years. You know, some of my biggest winners, you know, I got bought gold miners too early, you know, probably, I don't know, in some maybe over 10 years ago. And I had to sit for a year or two, like in a silver company. And next thing you know, when they pop and went up like 10 times, I made a bunch of money, but I had to wait. And if I'd been managing money, people would have been on the phone screaming at me, why are you accumulating this dog as it's crawling on its deathbed? And I didn't think it was on its deathbed, so that's why I stayed with it. So that's kind of how I do. I think it's much easier to time bottoms than it is to time tops, because I think tops can go on sentiment for years. I mean, I posted a chart before the NASDAQ bubble. I was early, 98, I was saying, this is insane. And of course it got more and more insane. I think in the last 6 months of 99, the NASDAQ went up 80%, and it had already been going up and up and up. So, but then again, I had friends that basically lost everything, in that, because they got in and they were doing great and they're doubling their money. And then one day it starts to go down, and, your pro investors can get out probably near the top, but your amateur investors, most of them don't. They'll hang on all the way down. And I've seen it, there's people that still own Cisco from 2000, when Cramer was buying it at 176 times earnings. I still remember that, and you had his Winners of Wall Street, these things go on. But anyway, to end my rant here, in the end, stocks are claims on real assets. Right. So you may argue they're super overvalued or whatever. I think, what does that mean nowadays when they've got a printing press? There's no gold standard like there was in the 60s. So there's no breaks. There's no breaks on the money supply anymore, anywhere on earth. So stocks survive hyperinflations and high inflations over time. I mean, at least they don't go, if they're not bubble stocks, but a company that's a real company, the stock, if you look at the stock market in Venezuela, in local currency terms, it's been straight up to the upper right, So as opposed to bonds. Now, I wouldn't buy bonds other than as a trade for you with your money if you paid me. I mean, I don't, I think bonds are insane, but there's still a lot of money in them. So anyway, that's and my thoughts on that.
Very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, in terms of your approach and philosophy?
So much of that, I'm a professional trader though. So stops are the critical element. And of course, see, if I'm much more patient, even though I still trade with stops, or I'll trade without orders, because if I look at something, and here, I look at something that goes up 300 or 400% and it's a real asset, as Rudy talks about, I start paring back stuff. Now, there are problems that, but I'm always, people are afraid of paying taxes. I have to argue with all my accountants in the world. I've gone through years where I've suffered some significant losses back in the early 80s when I couldn't get out of the mindset of the bear stock market, right? That because of all the debt. And yet I understood academically what Volcker was doing. But to make the pivot, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about myself. I lost, I've done pretty well being long gold and short the dollar, and then I never turned. So I've had years where I have suffered. So you do pay attention to that. And when you use leverage, as me as a professional trader, it's cheap for me to use it. So Rudy's point is very well taken, but that makes me be, some days as I get older, and I'm in my 70s, so I'll be more patient, especially with equities. Because I'll see and I'll wait for the formations. Here's a classic week. I've been long a lot of Tokyo Mitsubishi from $390 to $4, and I've paired it back between 13, 14, 15, and I'm still carrying half my original position. So this week was an interesting week because from a technical standpoint, and I learned from probably the best technician I've ever met in my life, Howard Green. He was a great technician. And you can look at a chart and you can look at Tokyo Mitsubishi, and it had a one-day stranded island with a low of 1587. Well, the other day, I think on Wednesday, somebody called me up and said, yeah, I know how you feel about this. What do you think? I said, well, it's got that stranded island. It's going to fill it today. The market hadn't even opened up. I said, I want to see what the high is. And the high was 1587, which perfectly filled the gap. Now I'll get more bullish if it can one day take out the high that it made on that lower, when the low was 1587. The high, I think, that day was 1617. So I'm waiting for a day where because I'm still bullish, but I need to get further technical proof of what's going on. The fundamentals, I think, are great. And Rudy's point, you can't really trade in this stuff because the algorithms drive so much of this, and they're much more price conscious than they are fundamental conscious, because momentum is in price. So that's what they adhere to, and they look and they search and they know where everybody else sets stops, because there's a lot of day traders and, you know, hour traders, and maybe people like me who might keep something for 2 or 3 weeks, and they're searching for them. So there's a lot more volatility in these markets because there's a lot more money. And ultimately, everything that we're talking about, when you talk about, and this is what I learned through my analysis of multinational corporations, so much of the world of finance is just global flows. And that's what I believe is my really strong expertise, is that I try to monitor global flows so I'm not caught in what Greenspan and others would call home bias. That's why I have such great admiration for Mark Faber and Louis Gavin and Peter Booker. Yeah. These are people who search and don't get so myopic in home bias. So, you know, it is a global flow of money. As Rudy talks about, we're not on a gold standard. We haven't been on a gold standard. Well, it was never a gold standard after the war. And Bretton Woods, as Jacques Roof, who was a very well-known French economist. In fact, he's the one who coined the phrase about America's exorbitant privilege back in the 60s, because the French were complaining about it. But we were on the gold exchange standard. Well, there's nothing. So the only thing that backs a fiat currency is good government policy, fiscal policy, and the credibility of the central bank. Without those, nothing. And so I'm always amazed at the press conferences that Powell and everybody before him, when they started doing his Greenspan, it was not a press conference guy, so he didn't care about it. But when they talk about, not one question comes from the lazy media about gold to Powell. Does this bother you? Because it was reported, and I have it from very good sources. I can't confirm it myself, but Paul Volcker used to say that gold was his enemy. Central bankers do not view gold as their enemy, because otherwise they would be, their policies, we told them, we wouldn't have had QE 2, 3, and 4. I had no problem with QE 1, because that was adding liquidity to stem a potential solvency issue. QE 2, 3, and 4, the solvency issue was over. That was just pumping liquidity into the system, and it was a global phenomenon. You know, don't forget, Europe had 5, 6, 7 trillion of nominal negative debt during COVID. Nominal negative debt. That's not real yields. Those are not, the bonds were negative. You were paying the German government. So again, it's a liquidity factor. And because central banks, and I'm like Rudy, I've been off the gold, because gold, the worst thing for gold throughout its history is positive real yields. If overnight, and I'm not talking about TAYA, overnight yields are positive. That's what Volcker did. He raised overnight rates and squeezed the system, in that we went to probably, even though inflation was 13, 14% when Fed funds and when they were up at 20%, you had a real yield. So he broke the back of inflation through the use of that. So when they were talking about Powell, remember the New York Times and the Washington Post, Powell's finding his inner Volcker. That's pure nonsense. Don't forget, too, when Volcker went that path, the debt to GDP level was 38%. Volcker couldn't be Volcker in today's world with a GDP of 105%. Couldn't do it. It would cost.
Right. Well, when you.
I'm sorry. Yes. I see.
No, I was going to say, but the thing is, my mind kind of glazes over when people talk about real yields, because that's assuming that you believe the cost of living is going up 2.9%, you know, and I don't. I, you know, what's the Fed funds at 4.3 or 4.25? It's, I mean, I would say my cost of living's going up double that. And when I say things like that on FinTwit, for every person, every economist who says, no, that's not correct, I get 50 people that say, oh my God, it's more than that. It's double digits. I mean, I know all my biggest expenses are all going up double digits, insurance and health insurance and auto insurance and home insurance, right? And I get a lot of confirmation on that from the 100+ thousand people that for some reason follow me. And so I question all these numbers. Look at the jobs. That's why I don't follow any, I don't follow the jobs number. God, how many man hours are wasted a year? Yeah. Trying to put a microscope on the jobs numbers. What a joke. And then they come out and go, oh, by the way, we made up a million, in the last year. Yeah. It's like, I know that people trade off it. And that there's, I mean, as a trader, which I am not, I'm more of an investor, I'm not a trader. I can understand the value in knowing what the number is and what people expect the number is, that 3 or 4 level thinking, but I don't even play that. I follow all the people you mentioned about Asia, Bukvar and Gavi, and they're great. I don't pretend to know anything about China. I mean, you listen to Louis Gavi, who's very positive, I think, on China, and then you listen to some other guys who are like, China's about to implode. So I just kind of wave my hands. And I do that with a lot of stuff. I'm no Buffett, but it's out of my area of expertise,
But, that's right. And you make the point. See, as a trader, whether I believe the numbers or not doesn't matter as a trader.
Correct.
Because it's all the data I got and everybody else is looking at it. And if I want to be a contrarian, it's an expensive way to go as a trader. Because don't forget, you're also implying for traders a lot of leverage. So that it's I respect exactly what you said. So for stocks that I own, I don't care about the unemployment number unless it was so far-fetched. And I believe that the jobs numbers have been far weaker. As to why, don't know. It could be the surveys. It could be. But and the Fed has no credibility because they create the SOM rule, right? The SOM rule is a model, another Fed model, fraud model. And that's why Bessent's article last week on the Fed was dead right, because the models are so flawed that the data comes up short. It was from the time I was in college and learned about the Phillips curve and being a globalist. Listen, my graduate work, I was studying multinational corporations, especially from a political economic perspective. I never accepted the Phillips curve because I said the Phillips curve is a domestic entity. It's a domestic model. And we saw it in 1991, 92, 93, as the wall came down in Europe, as the Chinese, especially in the late 70s, China was starting to open up. The amount of labor that was being foisted on the global system, and you saw it especially in the 90s, the Fed got away with it. Because it kept wages down because global capital was arbitraging global labor. And that's why we're in the situation there, because it ran amok and nobody answered to it. But the Fed, there's no wage inflation, no wage inflation, no way. Yeah, because of the effect of the global model, because of what was going on with the change in the world economy. The Phillips curve couldn't catch that because it was domestically based, totally desperate. So, I've had my problems, and Bessent is 100% right. I can't agree with him more on that. I thought the article he wrote was actually pretty good.
Oh, I was going to mention that. Yeah, that was great. I just wish I believed that the administration wanted any of that. I think, remember, Trump wanted negative rates,
right?
And he wanted more QE back in his first administration. So he's on monetary policy. I think he's as nutty as anybody. So that's just my 2 cents on that. Bessent's article was very good, though.
Because Bessent took the Fed to task, and that's what he did. And he says that's why we have to change. And you can deal with it. Everyone, Krugman can write about QE. Well, I respect Paul Krugman as an economist, as he was doing his work on Japan back in the 90s. I thought he did really good work on depression economics. His role as a public intellectual bothers the hell out of me, but you know, that's a time for a different discussion.
Yeah, I don't have any respect for the guy, but I didn't know him back when he was doing the work you're talking
Yeah,
about. I'm just he's off.
he was real
He's
good.
off
Yeah.
Twitter now, but he for an academic, I mean, he's completely clueless. He made a comment one time about is there any evidence that poor people suffer from inflation? I mean, that was like that was I mean, or suffer more from inflation. And I'm just like, that's the kind of cluelessness I get, you know, from these people on
Well,
FinTwit. And
and
most of whom have either blocked me or they don't bother me anymore. You know, they don't they avoid me.
well, I'll tell you
But
what, I can go back 3 days ago. He wrote it, and I don't read his stuff, but it comes to me
no.
Substack free. So if I see the
Yeah.
headline, so he was attacking something, and he questioned fiscal dominance. But I'll tell you what, I've listened to enough podcasts of John Cochran. He's at Hoover, but comes out of the University of Chicago. And his work, along with Charles Kalmaris out of the St. Louis Fed on fiscal dominance, is 100%. And if you don't believe in fiscal dominance, then you don't believe that debt, especially government debt, has any impact on finance. Sorry, if you don't, because we're in it now. And that's why Trump and others want lower rates, because the cost of financing this debt brings into question everything. And Richard, we've talked, and I'm sure you've heard me, Rudy. I said, once the interest costs, because my dear friend Kevin McCarthy, not the Speaker of the House, but somebody I went to graduate school with, and we still talk all the time, back in 2020, 2021, when we started to see the fiscal position in the United States deteriorate so rapidly, that the issue was going to be, even at zero interest rates, when the interest costs on the debt exceeds defense spending, you are in a very dangerous situation. That's historically
Of
right.
course.
Right? And nobody
Right,
would,
but
people looked at me like I was from outer space. I go, you watch, because now you've got to make decisions about, and the budget is probably the most political, is most important political instrument, because all those programs are now going to get challenged, and they should be challenged. Nobody's done it, and but this was going to call into that question. That's where the politics came.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, well, you know, Kevin Warsh had a great some great comments earlier this year where he says, you know, it was the Fed that wandered into politics by keeping rates at zero for a decade and by monetizing at the peak $9 trillion of debt and I think the you know of bonds. They what he's Warsh's words are, which I've posted all this stuff. What was the message to Congress? You can spend as much as you like, and we're going to buy it up. You know, and so, you know, look how much the debt and the money supply exploded, you know, under Powell,
Right.
who I had hoped when he came in, someone said, well, he doesn't have a econ PhD. I said, that's the best thing about him, you know, and he came from private equity. But of course, there's a wonderful article. I forget who wrote it about Powell's record at in private equity. And then what does he do during, you know, during his reign, at least until 22, he provided, you know, rocket fuel for, you know, Everclear for private equity, you know, zero rates for years. And, you know, he tried and remember the end of 2018, he was raising rates and they got up to about 2%.
Yeah.
And oh my God, CNBC, I still joke about it. Every day was like, this is the worst December since 1931 or something. And I'm laughing going, this is nothing like 1931, you goofballs. But they kept saying it, you know, they kept making 1930s references. And he chickened out. And I think I made a post in early 2019 when he said, "Oh, we're not going to do this anymore." You know, that the Fed is basically, they've abdicated their mandate to control inflation. You know, I had to live through, 10 years of every day, because I have CNBC on as white noise in the background. I've had it for years. I use it as a socioeconomic barometer of idiocy. And every day I'd hear someone come on and go, "There's no inflation," every day. And many, like Yellen, her only regret when she left the Fed, she said, was low inflation. Powell said low inflation was the problem of the century. You know, remember, these guys are saying it every day. They're saying there's no inflation. I'm yelling at them I'm yelling at my screen going, "What are you talking about? You know, you're in there. Of course there's inflation. There's always, as Peter Buchvar says, there's always inflation. We're just, that's why the CPI numbers, as Grant Williams points out, they've been adjusted so many times over the years, and every time it's to lower the CPI. And what's the incentive for that? Well, as COLA payments and all sorts of things, they don't, I think the real cost of living is going up close to 10%, frankly. And that seems so wacky when you look at, the government only says 2.9. It's BS. If people should take a look at how the CPI is actually calculated. You know, most people think, if something costs X this year and costs this Y in the next year, well, then whatever the difference is, we do the percentage and that's the increase. No. Once they threw hedonic adjustments in, we new car prices didn't go up for 25 years from the mid-90s. You know, that was in the CPI because, the car's better, so it's cheaper. And so I think, as I said before, the Fed wants high inflation. They just don't want to acknowledge that inflation is high, so they have all these little tricks. And it seems now we've completely abandoned the 2% mandate. By the way, their mandate is zero. It's stable prices in the 1977 Act. But 3%, you get billionaires like El Arian and Barry Sternlicht saying, "Hey, why not 4%? You know, I'm like, "Well, yeah, you're a billionaire. You don't care what inflation is. You benefit from it." So anyway, that's my main rant. I've been ranting against the Fed for years. It's good to see more people finally doing it. I mean, I think more people are awake now to the problem the Fed is. And the Fed is, like I call the Fed Congress's drug dealer. You know, I really think that's a symbiotic relationship they have.
Well, if you go, people talk about it. But if you go to Rogoff and Reinhart, this time is different. Rogoff, they put right in there that once that debt level gets above 90% and it impacts growth going forward, because, then if you want to put in Riccardi and equivalents, but they say you need, how do you relieve it? You run inflation for 3, 4, 5 years of 4 to 6%, because nothing takes care of debt like inflation.
Yeah.
Inflation.
Yeah, but to me, that's the most regressive tax.
It's a debtor's windfall. That's what it's there for. And that's what it's always been for, to bail out those with too much debt. So when you were on the gold standard and you had to actually, you couldn't just print your way out of it. So you went into deflationary cycles and whether they were repudiations or not, but that's how, and you went into a downturn because nobody could borrow. Basically what we had, and Richard Koo was really good at talking about the balance sheet recession, which if you read Bessent's article, even Bessent doesn't talk about Koo, but Koo was right. And he said, you just have to prepare for this. But, we have to go back to Bernanke, and it points to Bernanke, because Bernanke's whole world was 1937. And that was the greatest mistake. And he promised Milton Friedman they would never make that mistake again, by the way. At Milton Friedman's 90th birthday, he promised Milton Friedman will never make that mistake again. So they didn't.
And now he's very... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and now where is he? He's making tens of millions a year at Citadel and PIMCO. That's my thing. Listen, I understand. I'm completely aware of that. The way that they resolve this is inflation, and that's the way out. My point is, if as someone who cares about society, that it's super regressive tax, the most. It's going to harm most people. So Joe Blow has $20,000 credit card debt and high inflation. People say, the value of his debt he's paying back is less, but it's like, but his rent is doubling, and his car, to fix his car, doubled. You know, and so it's the big guys, it's the LREMs and the Sternlichs and the Ackmans and people like that who call for higher inflation, who benefit the most. I have a whole series of posts on the Weimar hyperinflation because of my name. Yep. And not only that, but other periods of history, every contemporary who lives through it says when you have high inflation or hyperinflation, which is not high inflation, it's a currency collapse. So it is a completely different thing. And I'm not expecting that, but what happens in high inflations is the poor and the middle class get totally screwed. And the wealthy capitalists, as they call them in the book, end up doing just fine and profiting. I mean, I can give you a dozen contemporary accounts of that. Now, 50 years later, you know, some economists may say, no, that wasn't very important. But believe me, the people who lived through the inflation, and that's another thing, is I think the hyperinflation of the 20s and the demoralization, how it destroyed, along with World War I, the morale and the fabric of society in Germany, directly led to Hitler. His push was in 1923. And he came to power, what, in 33? So there's an absolute connection. And, you know, some people think Trump is a fascist or something. I'm not calling him that. I don't think so. But be careful. Well, some of the things maybe. But be careful of what might be coming. You know, that's the thing. So I understand. I'm basically like Don Quixote tilting at the windmills. I joke about that sometimes. I put a picture. I understand that the almost certain end game is high inflation. And I just think that's going to be terrible for 90%+ of the country, who are all, many of whom are already suffering. And nobody cares about this, you know, nobody in financial media cares about it. And I'm not a leftist. I consider myself, I mean, I'm from the Austrian school. I think just from reading over the years, the guys I agree with tend to be the Austrians. And I'm, you know, I'm not a, you know, I've been called everything. I've been called everything from a Nazi fascist to a communist. Yeah. You know, so it's funny as hell, but okay. Because I'm not any of those things. I just would like to say, I don't like the direction the country is going. I mean, it's like all we care about is rich people, frankly. I mean, I got nothing against rich people. There's a lot of people that work hard and done well. I've done well, but I'm talking about more like the government created plutocrats we have, like that. I think like Lloyd Blankfein. Why is he a billionaire? You know, he was a failed hedge fund manager who got bailed out when the Goldman magically became a FDIC backed bank. Right. Same thing with Morgan Stanley. Well, remember that back in 08? And magic. Yeah, you're a bank.
You know, he came out of like. What's his name? Gary Cohn did out of when Goldman bought the big commodity company. They were huge in the metals on the floor, big presence. So they came out of there and made their way up through Goldman. So that's why, you know, I always laugh when I see your post, because it's Rudy Havers, and I can't agree with you more. And I'm sitting here, you can't see it, but I've talked about this book ad nauseum on these podcasts, but Keynes was also one, you know, you can't, Keynes was a phenomenally great economist, and not because of
he has a great passage about inflation. I posted it. He talks a lot about inflation and how it harms people. And if, sure. You know, I'll repost that after this. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
1923. And I've read this three times in the last year, a tract on monetary reform, which was coming out of the war and was directed at Austria first and foremost, because they were really suffering. And he's got four things in which, because, you know, Keynes had a great line, and you're going to laugh, you, and I'm sure you know it, to euthanize the rentier, right? The rentier class, those who own bonds and will only receive interest, because he felt that their political power was so great. And it's not that they really, they're not entrepreneurs. They're just there and collect and clip coupons. So in dealing with them, because again, that's what we're talking about, the debt. So Keynes mentions four. And when I was talking about this with Luke Roman on his podcast, and Luke's great line about the rarest commodity on Wall Street is a history book, which I love. But
yes.
But the name who J. Aaron was the company who Cohn and Blankfein came out of. But Keynes talks about the four things about how to get rid of debt. And number one is repudiation. Well, that's not going to happen. Luke kept going wider. Number two is depreciation of the currency. Number three is a devaluation of the currency. And this is to make sure that you pay off your bonds. And Luke went totally white on this when I said the fourth is a capital levy. Well, which one of those do you think are going to happen? And this is Keynes writing in 23. And Keynes wasn't just a great economist. And I've read the general, well, I could never read the whole general theory, but I read enough chapters of it when I had to in school. I was never a big fan, but these other books are really good. And I would advise everybody to read A Tract on Monetary Reform. You know, it's and Minsky writes on Keynes. So Keynes was a phenomenally good economist. He battled with the Austrians, but the Austrians understood, as far as I was always concerned, number one, the role of the entrepreneur in a capitalist system and the role of debt. You know, and Schumpeter, I love these. I still read a lot of economic history because it's valuable. And I look for things. What am I missing here? Just like you talk about. What am I missing here? What is it? Why is this time? You know, and by the way, when just because it's apropos, during Weimar, and I said this when I was blogging regularly in Notes from Underground, that I thought we were entering Weimar in 2019, 2020. And I said, you're going to look for an increase in political assassinations, because that's what Weimar was also about. The fringes were still volatile. And in fact, when you go look at the studies, as you bring up with the Nazi Party and fascism, the biggest movement was between the communists and the Nazis, for people who would go from being in the Communist Party to the Nazi Party, or from the Nazi Party to the Communist Party. They would go back and forth. Those are proven studies, you know, that people did years and years ago, because the fringe was the fringe, and that's where they meet. And they get, and you enter in very dangerous times. So I don't take these things lightly.
No, I hear you, and that's a concern for me. I just like to point out that, you know, I hear a lot of people, rightly so, saying, you know, well, there's no way out. We just have to inflate away the debt. You know, that's a very common thing to hear from mostly very wealthy people. And I'm like, okay, but let's be honest about it. It's inflation is a default. It's a stealth default, and it's very regressive. You're going to hurt the poorest people the most. And of course, you know, they don't have lobbyists, so it doesn't matter. Nobody cares about them. It is a default. Okay, so that's what I just want us to recognize that. It's not like, you know, we're not defaulting. And, you know, Greenspan, he said it himself in congressional testimony. He goes, I can guarantee you Social Security benefits as high as you want for as long as you want, but I can't guarantee their purchasing power. So, yeah, the people that, you know, we're going to pay these pensions and you're going to get your $3,000 a month or whatever, but it's only going to buy $1,000 used to buy. You know, it's like, right. You know. Yeah, so that's, I think people just need to recognize that, and I understand I'm kind of a voice crying in the wilderness on this, I'm not going to change anything. I want people just to be kind of aware of where we're headed. And you know, I did a podcast with Dimitri Kofinas a while back, and I talked a lot about this period we're going through now. You know, especially with the horrible shooting the other day and things like that, like the 20s in Germany. But it was a lot. Things were going really bad in the 60s and 70s, too, if you remember.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we lost, as I pointed out the other day, we lost, you know, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X within like a 5-year period. And, you know.
Yeah.
And
some great voices.
I don't know if they got the
unbelievable voice.
Right. And so, but we somehow came out of that. And I think what we needed which we don't have yet, is we needed a leader to try and unite us instead of divide us. And well, I certainly am not sorry that Kamala Harris lost. I don't think Trump is that leader. And I mentioned Reagan, you know, is a very polarizing figure. He did, you know, a lot of the bad economic things we have probably were his policies, but there was a lot of good too. I mean, the Cold War kind of ended at that time because of his actions. So, but Reagan was a guy, as a leader, strictly as a guy to come on TV and talk to America, who was self-deprecating. He would go have a beer with Tip O'Neill. You know, he didn't demonize his enemies generally the way that both parties do nowadays. And I think if there's a leader out there who, like, you know, just, I know that there's plenty of leaders out there who want to get up there and, like, demonize the other side, you know, and like with communists and the Nazis back in the 20s. But if we had a leader who was inclusive in not the youth, not the late meaning, but you know what I mean? You don't, you know, understand we're all Americans. And I think a big problem too, and I was bringing this up with Dimitri and others, is that I think a lot of Americans think that America is not Trump or any Biden's number one priority. I mean, we do so, you know, we're in 150 countries. We have troops and we've got bases in 80 countries around the world. And there's always money for war. There's always money to give to someone else to fight war, but we're cutting Medicaid, you know? And, you know, I'm sure there's a ton of waste and everything going on in Medicaid. And maybe we should try and address that, or fraud. But there was a podcast I was listening to, a real estate podcast, and the guy runs senior care homes or something. That's his business for 40 years. And he was talking about these Medicaid cuts, and he was like, this is what's going to happen. The rural hospitals are going to close down. They're going to flood the city hospitals. Those will close. In other words, there's going to be ramifications when we just basically say we have Darwinian capitalism for the poor and middle class, and we have, you know, endless breaks, it seems, for the very wealthiest, you know. And I don't know, again, I'm just being Don Quixote here, but it's just what I try to point out over the years. You know, if look at my pinned tweet on Twitter, and that kind of covers it. It's the two things.
Let me tell you something. I agree, and when I tell what I like, I don't listen to CNBC anymore because they don't have enough Santa.
No,
and the rest of them I have zero time for. And I listen.
You can feel your IQ dropping. I use it for humor value. Yeah.
No. I don't even put it on because I can't take the noise. But I don't buy defense stock because I'm not anti-war because I'll punch you right in the face as fast as anybody's.
Right. Same here.
But defense stocks pollute the entire budget process. And you saw that just in case you needed. Let's go back to 2012. And here's where Trump and the Republicans are as moronic as they might be. And that's not a partisan statement because I don't care. Right. I've been far on the left. I've never read, but I understand. I've read everything that everybody on the left has read and probably more, although not, this was not much listening, reading now. But if you go back to 2012, and I'm not sure if you've ever written about this, but the Bowles-Simpson committee put together by Obama really did some great stuff. And when they came up with their recommendations, I read it, and then I read it again. It was like 41 pages. And Alan Simpson, who certainly had great conservative credibility, talked about cutting the defense budget 10% to take, and you wouldn't even get to the muscle, but you can get that because the defense budget, in my view, sets up all the other malfeasance that takes place because it's easy to agree to defense funding. You know, you get a plant, you get a defense plant in your district, you get this, you get that, you get a base, everybody. And then once you get that, then it's just log rolling and trade-off. So, and that's why I thought the Bowles-Simpson amendment, and that's why the Republicans, they never should have had Doge. That was superfluous. They should have just said, we're going back to Obama, who got terrified. Obama never implemented. He ran as fast as he could from it, even though it was a nice bipartisan committee, a few idiots in there, but he had to put certain people on there. But the Bowles-Simpson would have gone a long way to this, and dealing with the entitlement programs, because I'm with you, you know, and I remember when Greenspan, they used to talk about it. In fact, I actually voted for Perot twice in 92, 96, because I was so concerned about debt and the deficit. And then after Perot lost, I went over on Madison Street, where I was, you know, down the street from the exchange where I was working at, and went to the Social Security Administration. I got an appointment with an advisor, and I said, look it, I want to opt out. Just give me every dollar I ever paid interest free up to this point, and I'll sign and I'll sign a contract that I will never ask for a dime for Medicare or Social Security. And they just laughed me out of there. And that's a, I said, I know. And then I believed that it should be means tested. And that got laughed out. But they laughed me out of there. I said, I'll sign it right now. I will sign a contract that I will never ask for a dime. Let me just have my money back interest free, and I'll go on from here. They laughed. So everything you talk about, Rudy, and debt has so much to do with it. So I was sitting and having a conversation one night with a dyed-in-the-wool liberal. It may have been, no, it was after the election. And I don't tell people the way I vote because it's nobody's damn business anyway. But she asked me a question about, well, what were your key, how did you, I said, you're not going to know how to vote. I said, my key issues, I had three key issues. I said, my first one is the deficit. My second one is Israel. And my third one is inner city education. Those are my three big things. And they don't seem to concern most people. So that's bothersome to me because the deficit is the most important critical element on the page. And she was like, and this is not a stupid person, you know, a high level attorney. It looked like me, like I was from outer space. You don't concern about abortion? I said, it's a luxury issue for me. For me.
Yeah.
These are luxury issues. Inner city education should probably be the first because that's not a luxury issue. And it's something I believe in greatly, that we have done such great harm to kids in the inner city especially. Because, again, just like rich people you talk about with their money, all these other rich people, they have choices. And even people who aren't that rich have choices as to where they want to send their kids. But the lower strata, they can't get out of it. They can't get out of it. So this is a severe problem. But again,
I totally agree. Yeah.
It's debt. All our problems that we thought, it's debt. There's no getting around it. And it's going to come back and continue to haunt because the burden of it increases every day, which is why they want to lower rates. And what did, you know, Marin and Bessent, and I used to have great, I still have respect for Scott Bessent. Marin, I've read the stuff. Yeah. But Bessent, as a global macro world, I had a lot of respect for, but he talks too much. I enjoyed his piece in the Wall Street Journal because he hadn't said anything for a while, and that made perfect sense. But what did the first thing they do? They criticized Yellen and Brainard for moving all those T-bills, for moving all the money forward to T-bills, and they've done it even more. So they know, they're telling you what a great problem this is. Now, people say, well, since you got the inflation numbers over the last couple of days, you know, long rates have come down and short. Yes, and as PIMCO wrote a piece yesterday, or they got interviewed at Bloomberg, and the piece was that they were taking off some of their steepeners. So I'm with you. I have for 10 years told, for sure 8 years, but probably 10, yet you can't buy anything longer out than 2 years. You're out of your mind. I said, I would not take any duration risk, any duration risk.
Well, here's the thing. When they cut rates, what's the government going to do? It's going to get in more debt. If they don't cut rates, what's the government going to do? Going to get in more debt. See, nobody's talking about decreasing the level of debt. It's right. The amount of the increase we're going to have. So I just think, you know, if we go to ZERP again, all you're doing is like giving more heroin to the addict, you know, or more cocaine to the addict, you know. But that's the way our society as a whole has decided to go. And a lot of it is the voters are to blame, you know. I mean, Americans are not libertarians. They want their free stuff, you know. Yeah. And you know, even Ron Paul, who I voted for more than once, he couldn't get more than maybe 15% of the conservative Republican primary vote because Republicans don't want they want free stuff and let the grandkids pay for it. And the Democrats are the same way. And I completely agree with you. And I posted on this a number of times before about the schools. That's a crime. And I think the biggest enemy there is the teachers' unions. But that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, we can. But when you look at all this, all these things, everything that we talk about, and I am a libertarian. Am I a radical libertarian? No, but I've read enough Hayek in my life. But even Hayek talked about the need for a social safety net. And I'm a big believer in it, because capitalism can be a very rough system, and that there needs to be, and Hayek, you know, who is probably more people will cite, you know, the road to serfdom. But when I was in graduate school, there was a guy who was working on a doctorate, who every night we would sit when we finally got out of the library at 11:30, 12, maybe later at night, we'd have the cheap pizza because they were going to throw it away, and we'd drink a beer. And he would discuss with us, I would discuss Marx, but he was doing his PhD on Hayek's The Constitution of Liberty. So it was to me like getting a seminar, because he was trying to, you know, how would you feel about this? And the discussions were deep. So I'm a big fan of Hayek, but I respect that Hayek, and it was one of the things that really attracted me to Hayek, is that he pushed for a social safety net. Because I think that that's an important thing, but it's what you do with it. Again, once you pollute the budget system and everybody does log rolling and trade-offs, it's we get very irresponsible very quickly, right?
Yeah, there's a great quote that I had posted. God, when did I post this? Many years ago. 2014, from Hayek. It's a quote from Road to Serfdom, where he talks about conservatism, though a necessary element in any stable society, it's not a social program. In its paternalistic, nationalistic, and power-adoring tendencies, it is often closer to socialism than true liberalism. And then, you know, the quote goes on. I mean, so someone reading that would think, oh, well, you know, he's not, you know, it's just interesting that you're right. He's deeper than just, you know, everybody's so black and white on things. I, you know, I'm more gray, and Hayek certainly had shades of gray in his thinking too. I think that I warned, you know, just off the top of my head thinking now, you know, when George Bush was in power after 9/11 and the Patriot Act and all that, they were giving the executive Cheney was pushing all this stuff, really. But executive branch, so much power. And I said to Republicans that I knew, I said, this is bad. You know, there's going to be a president you don't like someday who's going to have all these powers. And now here we are 25 years later. Look at all the things Biden did. And then look at all the things Trump is doing. So, you know, the people who are cheering on all these executive orders and everything, be careful, because you might have, you know, I'm just throwing a name out here who I hope never gets elected. Gavin, President Newsom could be right. You know, he does 200 executive orders.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Yeah. I mean, you know, and so be careful. We have a system that's, you know, as Russell Napier says, the U.S. has a constitution. It's a pretty good constitution. It's been stopping bad people from doing bad things for a long time. And I think, you know, that's why I know some of these judges are nutty, but we do have a judicial system as sort of a break on the legislature and the president. And, you know, if somebody's corrupt and incompetent, then impeach them and get the judge out. But I'm saying this, our founding fathers were pretty smart how they set this up, you know. And so you don't want to give one of the three branches of government too much power. And I think we really have. We've given the executive branch. And then there's the fourth branch of government, the Federal Reserve, which basically, you know, you could argue at times that Powell is the most important person in the world, you know, because he could cause the markets to crash 20% with one wrong phrase. So anyway, I'm just, you know, I like, I'm a small L libertarian. I like fire departments, and I like roads.
Just coming to a time constraint, if it's okay for one last question. On this, you mentioned earlier on your unusual investments that you're in that many others may not be. Just wondering what that is, if you could give like an example or two. Are we talking like Halyk Bank of Kazakhstan or Sibanye-Stillwater of South Africa? Yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah, I've mentioned it before. So I like, for many years I've been reading the Horizon Kinetics guys. I do own shares in their inflation fund, INFL. It's an ETF. I like the way they think. Steve Bregman and what's the guy's name? Murray Stahl and James Davalos, I think, are the three. But Bregman's, they're all great. And they write very good letters. And I've just been, they have a very kind of unique view of well, maybe not unique, but uncommon view of inflation. And so that's an investment that, I mean, now it's probably more popular, you know, although it certainly isn't bouncing like GDX and stuff. But for example, they're very big on things that'll benefit from inflation without necessarily having the costs associated with higher labor, higher. In other words, the CME is one of their investments. Yeah. Or royalty companies, whether it's in gold or silver or even coal, you know, they have, you know, they have all sorts of these little small royalty companies. So by owning that fund, it saves me having to research and buy all the individual funds. I just trust these guys. They also got me in another one that I've been in for years, Texas Pacific Land, which is one of my biggest winners. And periodically it'll go down 50% and over the years, and I'll buy more. And they have a thesis on that. You know, I don't think it's cheap particularly now, but that's been a home run for me, and I still own it. And so those are two, INFL and TPL, but I'm not recommending any of those, these prices.
Interesting. And your final thoughts, Ira, also on unusual investment opportunities.
I have somebody who I love to talk to about energy with, and I'm a big fan of Doomberg, and of course Guerin and Rosenzweig, even though they're in steep disagreement.
Oh, they're great. Yes. Also they're,
but I love that they disagree. And we've done a few podcasts we did one with Adam Rosenzweig, but we've, you know, through this, and more than a few with Doomberg, who I've great.
He's
and
great.
The fact that they're battling, I love it. And then I have a guy who I talk to who's an energy guy, Mike Lee's out of, and we talk because he lives where I do in Arizona, so we like to talk a lot. And he's very knowledgeable. And so, I will shift. I still have the score holding the banks, but I've been selling some off. I'm still looking at raw material prices, and I'm watching the yuan. If the yuan takes out, I'll tell you what I'm looking at. If the yuan could get below, because I'm talking about in dollar yuan, so if it gets below the 200 week moving average, it's been sitting below the 200 day moving average, but you know, and these aren't sacrosanct to me. I was able to learn under some great technicians, but certainly one, and it's not that they're sacrosanct, but you need to be able to define your risk levels or where is a place that I'm looking at or where I'm, because unlike Rudy, I trade with stops because the first and foremost, my job is to protect my capital. Mm-hmm. So, and because I'm a professional, and I always have been, and my commission structure is so low, it allows me that flexibility to get in and out. So, yes, and I look for things that really appeal to me. I love. We haven't done a FOBR in a while, but I always love listening to Mark, and you can find these there. I'm not one who runs with the crowd, but I don't covet what you make. So there's none of that. There's fear of missing out. It's never been investment methodology for me. God bless you.
Same here.
If you find your way, God bless you. But I'm going to look and I'm going to do my work. You know, there's people who I talk to, I have great respect for, and they may, listen, I love talking to Bookvar. Because Peter sees things. In fact, I was going to invest with Peter. And my wife says, why should we do that? You're in most of the same stuff anyway. Because when we would talk, I said, you know, honey, you're right. That's not going to give us any type of diversification. But but again, I'm very concerned about a lot of things that Rudy are concerned. Are they going to happen today, tomorrow? No. Is there going to be a day of reckoning? As far as I know, because historically it always tells you there's going to be a day of reckoning. Is it going to be a war with China? I don't know. Not smart enough to. But I will tell you this. If you think that the U.S. is going to risk thermonuclear war, you better rethink about everything. Because that ain't happening. And Nixon and Kissinger told us that back in 71 and 72. The United States was not going to risk thermonuclear war to save Taiwan. Was not going to happen. You know, just read through. So where does this go? I don't know, but I look, and there are places where everybody walks away from. And as Rudy makes a point out, equities are a good place to be because they call it the Zimbabwe symbol. When Zimbabwe's inflation, was 300% a day or whatever the number was, the only thing that saved people in Zimbabwe was owning the real assets that were in stocks, right? It was the only way to say that. Well, I mean, it could have been, of course,
in gold.
But at that time, and as Rudy talks about, gold really didn't, and I admire him. I can tell gold broke out, and the great Howard Green found it when the Bank of England sold off all its gold. Yes. 1999, 2000. And I went to Citibank, who I was doing business with, and tried to borrow a lot of money because I wanted to put a bid into the Bank of England for that gold. Because we were just getting a beautiful breakout, a linear breakout, fabulous gold in terms of the euro currency, which had just come on, started in 1999. But that chart was a phenomenal chart. So I always look at gold in terms of an international phenomenon. And I always monitor it. And Judd Hirschberg does a good job of that.
Hey Ira, you know how much, you know what the average price Gordon Brown got for selling his 395 tons of gold?
Yes.
I had a post on it from 2014. It said $275 an ounce.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Can you imagine? What great timing that guy had. Yeah.
And we were getting breakouts in terms of other currencies because euro. So there were, I laugh when I listen to you, really, because it's, you know, but, you know, you've been around, well, and I didn't start blogging until 2008, 2009, but 2009, I think. So, and now I've kind of stopped. But I always look at it as you do, with an outsider's view and an outlier's view. Yeah, if I agree with the masses, I'll absolutely will go into that. If I think energy is like with nuclear, I'm a big nuclear energy fan. I think it was a gigantic mistake. But yet, I lived through the failure of the Whoops bonds up in Washington State when their nuclear energy program never made it, and those bonds were defaulted on. So I love looking at debt. Debt tells me a great deal. Now, the Fed and other central banks have perverted especially the long end of the market through all their programs and their vast holdings. And one of the biggest problems was from day one, the central banks don't hedge their portfolios. So that removes an important player from the bond markets, which prevents you from seeing real outcomes. And again, one of my favorite bond guys and bank guys to watch, of course, is Chris Whalen, who I have great respect for. And because he's not afraid to say what he thinks. I'm amazed that sometimes, especially with his Wall Street background and clientele, but he does, he will say what he thinks, end of story.
Oh yeah. I quote him a lot. I quote every guy you've mentioned so far on this podcast I follow, I think. So yeah, we're simpatico on the type of people we listen to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And
okay. That's all I got.
Oh yeah. That's great. And just wondering quickly, Rudy, how can listeners and view, and in this case, just listeners, we're doing this as a voice, learn more about your work in terms of a link like to your Substack?
Sure. The Substack is rudy.substack.com, RUDY. And then on Twitter, I'm Rudy Havenstein, RUDY Havenstein, HAVENSTEIN. EIN, and it's the Twitter account is a mixture of absurd pictures and videos and also very serious stuff. So I joke that even my jokes are serious. So it's a mixed bag. Some people like it, and some people don't. So, and same thing with the Substack. All right, but this has been great. Thanks, guys. Honored to be
Thank you.
Somebody like Ira and you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And just Ira as well for learning more about your work, Ira?
Just here on the podcast.
Okay.
Richard, I don't know where I'm going now.
Yeah.
I'm getting to the only because, you know what? I'm trying to monetize myself, and it's been a flawed game to play, unfortunately, because what you do, and Dennis Gartman, of course, always told me, if you give it away for free, nobody will ever pay for it. So I get it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to figure this out. So they'll see less of me until they see more of me.
Okay. Yeah, if there's anybody in the audience that has suggestions and ideas, yeah, feel free to send us an email as
I
well
will
on that.
listen. Yeah, you got
Okay.
an idea? I'll be
Yep.
the first to listen to you.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
Yeah,
All right,
thanks very much,
Rudy,
Rudy
this was
and Ira.
great. I appreciate
Yeah.
your time.
Thank you. My
All
pleasure.
right, great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep. Thanks. Take care, guys. Yep. Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.